Ja. Så synes jeg, giv en stor hånd. Ja.
I didn't understand one word of Danish. Except I was listening with my heart, and the readings have a certain rhythm to them that I could understand even though the words weren't my language, my primary language. So I love Narcotics Anonymous, and I'm really grateful. I want to give my thanks first to God for His grace and His mercy. And if you're new to Narcotics Anonymous and you don't know yet about grace and mercy, I want you to know that grace is when you get something that you do not have coming. Mercy is when you do not get something that you do have coming. So I'm grateful. Blessed to be back in the beautiful country of Denmark and to be reunited with all of my friends from the Bornholm Convention. I came here some years ago and had a wonderful experience. God has blessed me so much in my journey of recovery, and so I'm really grateful too for the new friends that I'm already making here in South Denmark in Esbjerg. I want to thank the South Denmark area for extending an invitation to my husband John to come, and I just kind of jumped in the car with him and said, I'm going too. And then when I got in the car with him, my whole little crew from Phoenix, Arizona said, hey, we're going too. So I just brought a crew. I just brought our recovery. Some of you out in the sitting area before the meeting started, and also if you're back from a relapse, I want you to know that, you know, welcome home. I'm glad you made it back alive. My brother relapsed with over 10 years clean in 2003, and he was dead in a month. He'll never be back in the rooms. This disease is treacherous, and it doesn't care how much recovery you had. Once you make the decision to pick up and start using again, the end can be very near. And so welcome back if you survived a relapse recently. And I hope that you'll get together with your sponsor and ask him, what can I do different? What can I do different? Because if you do the same thing, you're gonna get the same result. So I don't really want to share too much about my story. I have so much, I just want to give all of what's inside of me to all of you. But my story is long ago and far away. I've been clean, I'll tell you, since the 15th day of September, 1981. Woo! Woo! I was over 30 by the time I got clean, so go ahead and do the math, and yes, I am old. I am the mother of two addicts, and both my kids are in recovery. My daughter's been clean 23 years. My son's been clean 14 years in July. grandmother of six, and three of them are heroin addicts. One of them is clean and going to meetings in Phoenix, Arizona. My other grandson is dirty and getting ready to go to prison probably. And my granddaughter is missing in action and just got out of prison, and I'm not sure what her story is at this point. When people are using in my family, they avoid me like the plague because I represent that there really is another way to live. And I've been an example of that in my family for a long, long time. And before I got clean 35 years ago, nobody in my family had ever recovered from addiction, even though there have been generations of addiction before me. So I think that God has really blessed me with his grace in that way, and I hope that you'll continue to help me pray for my grandchildren as they struggle with this disease and try to find their way into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. I do know for sure that this works. When everything else failed, when everything else that I tried before Narcotics Anonymous, the new relationships, the new towns, the new jobs, the new this, the new that, the let's go shopping, like when everything failed, going to the local psychiatric clinic, running to the local church, when all of that failed, Narcotics Anonymous worked. And it's worked for me flawlessly. My story is that I have never used since my first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. If you're new to Narcotics Anonymous, sometimes when you're in treatment, they will say, relapse is part of recovery. I'm here to tell you it is not. Relapse is part of the disease. You can come to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, stop using, and never use again if you follow our path. And the path is the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. If you get in the rooms and you get confused about what the path is and you hear somebody talking stuff and it sounds really good, ask them to show you where that's at in the literature of Narcotics Anonymous. That way you're getting the program, not their opinion. Okay? Just ask them to show you. Tell them you're new. I'm new. Sometimes I say that. I'm kind of new to this. Can you tell me where that's at in the literature? Oh, it's not in the literature. Well, it's a bunch of shit then, right? Okay, so here. Okay, as long as we got that straight. I have to tell you that I got clean before the basic test. I got clean before crack cocaine. They didn't even have crack when I was still out there using. So I like to tell people I got clean in 1981 BC. That's before crack. And it was before the first edition basic text. And I got clean before the flat book. And I got clean before the Just for Today book. And I got clean before Works, How, and Why. And I got clean before Living Clean, The Journey Continues. And I got clean before the New Tradition Study, the Solutions book that's just come out. When I got clean, there was no book. There was no books in Narcotics Anonymous. And the miracle of my recovery is that out of the 12 addicts that were in the greater Seattle area where I got clean in the United States, those original 12 members, all of them stayed clean. And they're still clean today. And I believe it's because we gave each other intensive care. We hung on to each other, we clung to each other, we had to figure stuff out on our own. And what we figured out right away is that gratitude is an action word. It's not something you say, it's something you do. I believe that if you're a member of Narcotics Anonymous and you are being of service in one form or another, that you're still trying to get a free ride. You're still trying to get something for nothing. And this is about paying back the debt that I owe to society in general, the debt that I owe to so many people in my life in particular. Like, the debt that I owe to God, because everything I am and everything I will ever be is because of the grace of God. So it doesn't matter what I use. It doesn't matter, how much or how little I had. It doesn't matter who my connection was. It only matters what I wanted to do about my problem and how you guys can help, right? That's what the literature says. So I will tell you that I started using drugs in 1964, and I stopped using drugs in 1981. In between 1964 and 1981, I was in and out of mental institutions. I had four failed marriages and divorces, four times by the time I was 30 years old. I had two teenage children when I got clean that were using drugs with me on a daily basis because I thought that I was teaching them the ropes. I thought getting loaded was the only way to live, and that by teaching my children how to live and who the connection was and what to look for, and that I was helping them. I know today that I was abusive, that I was neglectful, that I was derelict in my responsibilities as a parent. That's where drugs take me. That's where addiction takes me in my life. I was unfit to parent my children, but no one in my world had the courage to intervene. And so by the time I got to Narcotics Anonymous, I had a ninth grade education. I was unemployed and unemployable, and I had been unemployed for over 18 years. I had my first baby while I was chained and shackled to a delivery table in a women's prison. If you got here from a prison because of Narcotics Anonymous H&I meetings, raise your hand. Let me see you. H&I. They're selling their merchandise out there in the lobby, so if you haven't stopped by to do your shopping, feel free to get out there. I put in my plug for H&I. Yeah. They actually let me help set up the merchandise, the H&I merchandise table and do sales, except what happened. It was kind of like when I was selling dope. I was my best customer, right? Like, no, not one person bought anything from me, but I walked away with like 1,000 kroners worth of merchandise, so I think they fired me now. Anyway, the thing was when I was using that I couldn't keep from getting loaded. Like, I remember that for a long time in my using, there were other people in my world that wanted me to get clean. You know, my children would say to me, Mama, please don't go tonight. Please stay home tonight, Mama, please don't go. And I would go anyway. Or my husband would say to me, hey, babe, stay home. What's up with that? Come on. And it's like, no, I would go anyway. Or my parents would say to me, you're neglecting your children and you're not taking care of your responsibilities. And I would blow them off like they didn't know what they were talking about. And I would go anyway. But what happened with me was that I got to a place in my recovery where I wanted to stop, and I could not. I couldn't stop. I got to the place where, when I started, I was using mostly on the weekends. I was kind of a weekend warrior. And then the weekends started on Thursday, and they ended on Monday. And pretty soon it was Wednesday and Tuesday, and pretty soon I was using every day. But then I got to a place with my disease where I was using all day, every day. Not just every day, I was using all day, every day. Finding the ways and means to get more. And I could not stop. I could not stop even when I wanted to. And so, God intervened for me. The last time that I used, I was brutally beaten. I was left on the side of the highway dead, for dead. They thought I was dead, I'm sure. I had a fractured skull and a broken jaw and a broken nose, and my eye socket was fractured. I'd been stabbed twice in the back and dumped on the side of the road. And I spent the first 15 days clean in an ICU in Seattle, Washington, intensive care unit in Seattle, Washington. And while I was in that unit, I was trying to find a way to steal enough medication to kill myself, because I knew that I could not continue to live the way that I'd been living. And I knew that everything I'd ever tried to change the way I was living had failed. And so I was hopeless. I felt hopeless, and I was filled with despair. And I remember this one time when I'd got treatment way back in the 70s for alcoholism. And I'd been introduced to a program for alcoholics. And I tried to make that work for me. I didn't know that I was an addict at that point. I knew for sure I was an alcoholic. And I thought there was a difference. I didn't know that alcohol was a drug. I thought it was a beverage. And so I tried to recover through another program in another way. And the literature in that program didn't resonate in my spirit. It didn't fit for me. And I couldn't understand. And I ended up loaded again after 6 months, and then I couldn't stop, I couldn't shut it back down. And so now in this intensive care unit, I know that that was the closest I ever came, was that one time when I'd given that a try. And so I called those people, I called the other fellowship, and I said, listen, lady, I'm not just an alcoholic, I'm an addict. I can't use anything. Everything I've ever used in my lifetime, I'm addicted to. One is never enough for me. And she said that she didn't think that she could do anything to help me. And I remember that feeling like I'm the hopeless case, like I'm the lost cause. Like, I'm so worthless that they can't even help me, right? That total feeling like my life is over. And I remember that I began to weep on the phone. I began to, this sort of soft animal whimpering, like you hear an animal laying in the woods that's been wounded or injured so badly. There was this whimpering sound that I could hear coming out of me, but I was very detached from it. It was like somebody else. It was happening to someone else. And the woman on the other end said to me that she had heard about a program called Narcotics Anonymous, and she said that she didn't have a number, and she knew no way to get a hold of these people, but that she would try. And that if she couldn't find them and have somebody call me back, that she would call me back herself. And about 15 minutes later, when the phone rang in that hospital room, I picked up the phone, and the woman on the other end said, my name is Alice. I'm a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I said, listen, Alice, I've already stopped shooting heroin, and I stopped shooting methamphetamine, and I've stopped snorting cocaine, And so I'm not one of them, right? And she said, I don't care what you use. I don't care who your connection was. I don't care how much or how little you have. I only care about what you want to do about your problem and how we can help. And she carried the message to me for Narcotics Anonymous. And I have to tell you, from the first time I heard the literature, the first time they read Who is an Addict, and the first time they read it, How It Works, and the first time they read the 12 Traditions, like, it resonated in my spirit. The language of Narcotics Anonymous, the words of our literature resonated in my spirit, and I knew that I'd found the place where I belong. I knew it. I knew it inside me, in my spirit. And I remember thinking to myself, if I do what these addicts are doing, these clean addicts are doing, and they're staying clean, maybe I can stay clean. And so I made a decision. I was going to give Narcotics Anonymous 90 days to work for me, and if it didn't work, I was giving it back. And you know, what happened was those 90 days came and went, and I didn't use, and I didn't cheat, and I didn't lie to you guys about being clean. I really did stay clean for those 90 days, the way you told me. I picked up the phone, I called when I wanted to use. I went to meetings every day, sometimes 3 meetings, 5 meetings a day. Sometimes I had to go to meetings that weren't Narcotics Anonymous because NA was so small in my area that there wasn't a meeting every day. So I had to go to other fellowship and I had to take out the word alcohol and put in the word addiction. And somehow I stayed clean for 30 days. A girl who couldn't stay clean for 24 hours stayed clean for 90 days. At the end of the 90 days, I did an evaluation of my life and I thought, okay, I still have a 9th grade education, I'm still unemployed and unemployable, I still got 2 teenagers that are using drugs on a daily basis because that's what I taught them. I still had my first baby while I was chained and shackled to a delivery table in a women's prison. Like, on the surface, nothing in my life has changed, but in my spirit, something radical had shifted. Something radical had shifted from this woman that was filled with hopelessness and despair to a member of Narcotics Anonymous who really had been given the gift of hope and the belief that if I just continue one more day and one more day and one more day, that my life would change. And so I decided to stick around. And I decided to stay until it didn't work anymore. And so far, it's been 35 years, 5 months, and some days. And this is still working for me. So I'm still here working it. And, I've had a lot of lessons through the years. There's a couple of things that I really want to talk to you about. I want to talk to you guys about relapse, and I want to make sure I stay on time. I want to talk to you about relapse, and I want to talk to you about love. I had a hard time with the whole God concept when I got here. I'd been raised in the Christian faith, in churches. My dad was a drunk. He was brutal. My mother was a religious fanatic, and every Sunday we were required to go to church. And every Sunday the minister said that if I was just good and if I just did the things that God and Jesus wanted me to do, then I was going to be rewarded for that. And in a child's mind, I thought that meant right away. And so I went home from Sunday school and church every Sunday expecting that my dad would be sober, just once. Expecting that maybe this is going to be the Sunday that he's not going to beat my mother or brutalize us kids or torture our animals. And those Sundays never came. They never came. And so I was pretty mad at God by the time I started picking up and using. I rejected the church completely. I rejected God completely, and I just decided I'm going to go to hell, and I'm going to have a good time on my way to hell. And so when I got to the rooms in Narcotics Anonymous, and I first saw the steps up on the wall in the meeting room, I remember thinking to myself, I'm fucked. I am so fucked, because like right away I saw the word God in the steps. And I thought that I was going to be in trouble because I was not going to connect with God. You cannot make me do it. And so I struggled. I struggled for several years in the beginning. And when I had about 3 years clean, my sponsor asked me to think about God and to really do some writing, like, what is God to me? And she said that she thought that I was trying to overcomplicate it and make God like this complicated thing. And so she wanted me to figure out God for me in his simplest form. And I remember this little verse that I had as a child that was so simple. It said, God is love. And I thought, how much simpler could it be, right? God is love. And so I decided that that was how I was going to connect with God. And I decided that if I can connect with people in a kind and loving way, then I must be living in God's will instead of my will. A lot of times when I connect with people and I'm in my own self-will, things don't turn out too good. And so I began to practice love as a way to connect with God. And whenever I felt that love, I would give it the word God, and I would say, I feel God-ness in my heart for you. And that became a way for me to connect with a power greater than myself. So as I went into my recovery, I had a lot of trial and errors, and I'm going to get back to the whole God is love story, but I'm going to digress for a little bit. So as I'm growing up in my recovery, I'm making a lot of mistakes, and I'm learning from my mistakes. The one mistake I can't afford to make is to pick up and use. Everything else can be repaired through the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. Relapse is so dangerous for us because many of us do not survive it. And you never know which time's gonna be the time for you. So I'd much rather, if you're here tonight and you're thinking about getting loaded, I'm glad that you're here, because I would much rather be in a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous thinking about getting loaded than sitting in a dope house somewhere thinking about getting clean, you know? So I was pretty much a hot mess, and I was making mistakes all the time, and life was showing up on life's terms. And I had a period of time in my recovery, I think from maybe between 14 and 22 years clean, I had 7 years where more than half of my biological family died. My father died. My grandmother died. My little sister was diagnosed with cancer and died as a result of the cancer. And my mother took a fall, was severely injured, and spent 2 years recovering from multiple brain surgeries and other surgeries that were required for her to heal. And we had just gotten my mom through her trauma when my brother decided to relapse and died. And it just took the wind out of me. It was like for the next 3 years after my brother was killed, I felt like I could never quite catch my breath. It just knocked the wind out of me so hard. It was so emotionally devastating on top of everything else that had happened and all the deaths that had preceded his relapse and his dying that, I just kept showing up. I just kept showing up, and you guys just kept walking me through it. And I don't even remember a lot of those 3 years. And I didn't use no matter what. And somehow we got through that. But those mistakes that I made and those lessons that I learned I frame those in a way, and I talk about them as a relapse, as a behavioral relapse. And so, you know, if you're new to Narcotics Anonymous and you're sitting here and you're thinking about getting loaded, I did that when I was a newcomer. But I was afraid to tell anybody, those other 11 people, I didn't want to tell them I was thinking about getting loaded because I didn't want them to think there was something wrong with my program. I didn't have anything to feel good about before I got here in my whole life. And when I got here and I started to stay clean, I began to feel good about that. And I began to develop some feelings of esteem for myself because I was staying clean. And so I was afraid that if I told the other addicts that were in the rooms with me that I was thinking about getting loaded, that they would think there was something wrong with me. And their opinion of me was really important because their opinion of me was much better than my opinion of me. Much better. So I didn't tell them. Now, when I'd been around for 15 years or when I'd been around for 20 years, my disease showed up in other ways. I wasn't thinking about getting loaded anymore. I was thinking about putting a bunch of money on my credit cards that I couldn't really afford. Or I was thinking about that carrot cake and that chocolate cake that was sitting out there, you know, because I'm a like sugar addict, like, yeah, bring it on. I was thinking about that. I'd drive around with a 2-pound bag of M&Ms on the front seat of my car, and I'd be sitting in the meeting fantasizing about getting back out there and eating those. Or I'd be thinking about him. You know, him. Yeah. Oh God, those jeans looked so good on him, did they? I'm telling you. I'd be sitting in the meetings, and I wasn't even listening to the shares that were going on because I'd be thinking about going to the casino. Or I'd be thinking about getting on the internet and doing like the stuff I do, or I'd be thinking about, like, my disease shows up in so many ways. Now the thing was, when I had 15 years and I was thinking about jacking up my credit cards with compulsive obsessive shopping, I didn't run to the rooms and tell on myself, right? I didn't want you guys to think, by that time in my area, I had some of the most clean time that there was around. So I didn't want, again, for you guys to think there was something wrong with my program. So I didn't jump up and run into the rooms and go, hey, I just put another $1,000 on my credit cards that I can't afford to pay. Because I thought if you had a credit card, you had money, right? And so what happened for me, whether I was a newcomer thinking about getting loaded or an old timer acting out my disease in some other way, the minute that I have that secret going on in my head and I make a decision not to tell you guys about it, what happens is I begin to separate from you mentally. I'm keeping it secret in my head and I'm separating from you mentally. So then I'm sitting in a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, and I know I've got a dirty little secret, but I'm not going to talk to you guys about what's really going on in my life because I want you to think highly of me. And so I start to have feelings about the secret I've got. I start to feel guilty and ashamed of myself, and I start to feel somewhat depressed, and I start to feel distant from you guys. But I can't really come to the meetings now and talk to you about how I'm feeling, because if I talk to you about how I'm feeling, you're going to want to know what's going on in my head. And so I make another decision, and the decision I make is that I'm not going to talk to you guys about how I'm feeling. And I begin to separate from you emotionally. So now I've got a dirty little secret and I'm separated from you mentally. I'm having feelings about it that I'm not telling you about, and I'm separated from you emotionally. So after the meetings, we would all go out and get coffee, or we'd go break bread together, and we would socialize, and we would have some fun and chit-chat and crack up at each other's jokes. And except now, while we're out having coffee or getting food together, you say, geez, Brenda, you've been really quiet in the meetings lately. Haven't been talking much about what's going on in your head. You haven't been sharing your feelings. What's going on? And I remember thinking to myself, yeah, I probably need to stop coming for coffee with these guys. They're trying to get too much information, right? And so I begin to separate from you socially. I stop going out and having coffee. I stop breaking bread because you're starting to get up in my business now a little bit, right? So now I'm sitting in the meetings of Narcotics Anonymous, and I find myself arriving just 1 minute before the meeting starts. And the second the circle breaks, I'm running out the door. I'm running out the door. And one night I'm running across the parking lot as fast as I can, and one of you guys, it might have been Debbie or it might have been Elizabeth, but somebody chased me across the parking lot and said, Brenda B, what is going on with you? You're not talking in meetings about what's going on in your thinking. You're not talking in meetings about your feelings. You're not going out with us to have coffee or break bread anymore. What's going on with you? And I mumbled something about, I'm fine. Life's good. I'm good. Life's good. I'm fine. And I roll up the window real fast and I drive off. Bye-bye. And I make another decision. The decision is that you guys are really fucked up for chasing me across the parking lot, right? Because now I'm starting to get twisted and all the symptoms of my disease are back, like the literature talks about, without ever picking up and using. And I'm feeling depressed and I'm feeling anxiety again because I've got a dirty little secret and all the symptoms of my mental illness begin to come to the surface again. And I tell myself, I need to stop going to these meetings because these motherfuckers will not keep their noses out of my business, right? Because I'm twisted now. I'm back in the grip of a continuing illness whose ends are always the same. Jails, mental institutions, and death. So now I'm at home. I'm not going to meetings. I've separated from you mentally, emotionally, socially, and physically. I'm staying away from you. Now I'm holed up in my apartment. I am completely caught up in the grip. I'm completely obsessed and compulsive, and I've stopped caring about anyone but me. The literature says the spiritual part of my disease is my total self-centeredness. So now I am completely self-centered, and I've stopped caring about anyone but me. And at that point, I am a hair's breadth away from active addiction. I'm in a full-blown relapse, in my opinion. I'm in a full-blown relapse without ever picking up and using. If I pick up and use, my relapse is over and I'm back in the grip. I'm in active addiction, back to active using. The other alternative I have at this point is to drop to my knees and pray for the willingness to become willing. I can't tell you how many times in 35 years I had to pray for the willingness to be willing to do one thing different. Show up one more time, go to one more meeting, work one more step, call my sponsor one more time, pick up the phone when I didn't want to again and again and again and again. And so I dropped to my knees. I prayed to God for the willingness to become willing. And you know what happens? You know how God has delivered every single time I prayed that prayer? One of you guys shows up knocking on my door. Brenda, we know you're in there. We're not leaving. You might as well answer the door. Yeah, the neighbors are probably gonna start coming out of their houses when we're still here at midnight hammering on your door. Open the door. You know, you guys show up. You guys show up and God brings me recovery one more time through the members of Narcotics Anonymous. You are the power greater than me. You are the face of God with love written it all over it, every single time that you show up. And somehow, you bring with you the willingness for me, and I can get caught up. I can get that spark of hope again from you, because God seems to crack my mind just enough to let in the willingness to connect with you one more time. And I get back to doing what I have to do. I have to go to meetings when there's 1,000 other places I'd rather be. I have to share about what's really going on in the rooms when I want to lie to you and tell you and keep everything secret or not even talk to one asshole in the room. I have to pray to God when I don't believe God is there. And I have to take a look at myself where I do not like what I see. And those have been consistent in my recovery. And so the spiritual antidote to that relapse that I just talked about is the connection. It's ironic that when I was getting loaded, the most important person in my life was the connection. And in my recovery, it's the connection that I have with recovering addicts. That's the most important thing in my recovery, is the connection, and that is you guys. So, you know, God did change my life, and I did get an education, and I did go to college, and I did get a job finally, because the seventh tradition said we're self-supporting through our own contributions, right? And, keep an eye on this. And so I just, in June of last year, I retired after a 31-year career in social services in Seattle, Washington. And I moved down to Phoenix to join my husband, John, who's gonna be your speaker tomorrow. And I want you to know he's like the real speaker at our house. He's got the really good shit. So if you're here tonight and you wanna hear the really good shit, you better come back tomorrow. And so, through the course of this fabulous career, I'm going to get back to God is love. Through the course of this fabulous career, God used me. God has been so good to me. I can't even tell you. In 2009, I was sharing this earlier, 2009, John and I, who are both convicted felons, his jacket was so dirty that they had him on the terrorist watch list to fly between states. Like, not even countries. I'm talking between states in the United States. They'd rip his bags apart and check on him. And so we could not travel anywhere. We couldn't go to Canada even, or, you know, we couldn't go anywhere. And in 2009, we were invited to speak, to be part of a team of addicts in long-term recovery to go to the White House. And I remember telling the people that were gonna do the security clearance for us, like, no, you don't understand. We are both convicted felons, multiple convictions. Like, you're not gonna get us cleared for the White House. We can't even get out of the neighborhood without the cops stopping us, okay? And the guy said, no, we'll get you clear. And so, you know, through whatever happened, like, I don't even know what happened. I just know that by the time the United States Secret Service and the Central Intelligence Agency got done with the security clearances for me and John, ever since then, we can go anywhere. We can travel to any country. We've never been stopped again. They never check our bags. We just look like two old folks that are like on vacation, right?
We are.
Oh, yeah. And so, like, that's the miracle. Like, God is more powerful than countries. He's more powerful than the White House. He's more powerful than the cross. If God wants you to go somewhere and carry your message of recovery, don't you worry. He's going to hook you up. He's going to hook you up. And that's the truth. So for 31 years, I worked on the streets of Seattle with homeless, derelict addicts. People, some of the people I work with have lived under bridges for 20 and 30 years. Under the bridges. And I worked with, I worked in a level 5 trauma center, which is the largest trauma center north of Los Angeles in the United States. And the doctors in the emergency department would call me, and I could put addicts into treatment, and I could use the courts. I worked through the prosecutor's office, and I could use the court system to send an addict to treatment whether they wanted to go or not. It's called an involuntary commitment. And so they called me one day from this trauma center, the same trauma center that I was contemplating my own suicide in some 30 years earlier. And they asked me to come over and speak to this old man that was there. He'd been living under a bridge for over 30 years. They warned me before I went into the room that they had not deloused him yet. And he was so, he'd been in the same set of clothing for so long that the clothing and his skin were, they couldn't get the clothing off of him without tearing his skin. They had to take him to a decontamination unit, but they hadn't taken him there yet. They told me that he smelled very foul. And so I went into the emergency room, and I saw this little, small, old man sitting on the gurney. And he had his head down. He would not look up and make eye contact with me. Some of you might remember when you were at the place at the end of your addiction where you couldn't look people in the eye, when you had so much shame that you couldn't lift your head up to make contact with people that were just passing by even. That's where he was. And I walked up and I began to talk to him. I began to tell him that I wanted to send him to treatment, that he was very, very sick, that he might even be dying, and that I wanted to send him to treatment. And I let him know that he didn't have to get clean or stay clean. He didn't have to stay clean. That he was just gonna, we were gonna just give him a place to stay for a couple months, a nice warm bed for the first time in 30 years, some clean clothing, 3 meals a day for the first time in a long time. Give your body a chance to heal a little bit so the doctors can figure out what's going on with you. And I promise you, like, you don't have to, if you don't want to go to the classes, you don't have to. You can just sleep in. If you don't want to take any medication, you don't have to. If you don't want to stay clean or stay sober when it's over with, you don't have to. Just go for a while and give your body a break and let's see what comes of this. And at some point I realized that he'd lifted his face and was looking at me. And then I realized that the reason he was looking at me is because I had reached down and laid my hand on his hand. And it was probably the first time he'd been touched by another human being in decades. And as he looked up at me, and I looked into his eyes, I heard this voice say to me that he needed an NA hug, like we connect heart to heart with our hugs. Some of us have been so deprived of healthy touch for so long. And that was this man's story. And I remember it was like this argument going on because I could hear this voice telling me to give him a hug, and then this other human part of me was resistant because he smelled so bad and because he was covered in urine and feces and because I knew he hadn't been deloused and I was probably going to get head lice and scabies and all sorts of little creatures. And then I just took a hold of him. I just took a hold of this old man in my arms and I hugged him the same way that I would hug any one of you. And I'm a good hugger. I got a lot of practice. I gave that old man a hug and he laid in my arms and wept. He wept because it had been so long since he'd had human contact. And I remember again hearing what I believe was the voice of God saying to me that he needed that hug far more than I needed to worry about getting any kind of bugs or body lice or... And that little man agreed to go to treatment and he let me send him and I held his hand and went through the whole process with him. He was in intensive care for 2 weeks, kicking alcohol and other drugs that he was addicted to. And he went to treatment and he completed the whole 60 days. And when he got done with treatment, he came back out and got drunk. And within a week's time, he was dead. And I don't know if that hug did anything at all to change that old man's life. But my whole life changed that day when that old man was in my arms. Because that day I realized that I'd been working my program and I'd been telling myself I worked a good program because I tried to do loving things to people that were really pretty easy to love. And that day I realized that working a good program is not about doing the easy shit. It's about doing the hard stuff. Reaching out with God's love is about loving the people who are hard to love. I call them porcupine people. You know, you get a little close and you get pricked. Uh-huh. Sometimes I'm the porcupine person, right? Sometimes I'm the one that's the hardest to love. And so I've changed my program. And I began to reach out more, you know, to the people who get to the rooms and they're severely mentally ill. Their mind has been devastated by the drugs that they've been using. They're hard to love. Sometimes it's hard for me to love them. They can't even sit down. Sit the fuck down. Quit going to the coffee maker 15 times. What the fuck are you using? I get frustrated with them, right? That's how I am. And so I get to practice tolerance and patience and acceptance. And I get to practice some unconditional love. And I get to work my program and become a better person. I get to replace that defiance and that rebelliousness and that intolerance, impatience with spiritual principles like patience, tolerance, acceptance, unconditional love. And as a result, if I act out those spiritual principles long enough, what happens is I become a patient person. I'm far less rebellious and defiant because I become more willing as I practice the spiritual principle of willingness in my life. I become even more willing. I'm a willing person. I'm a caring person. I'm a loving person. That's not who I was when I got here. This program has changed my life. And I'm grateful that I get a chance to practice love with the porcupine people, and that I get a chance to practice love with me. Out of all the people I've ever tried to love in my whole life, I'm the hardest one of all for me to love. And if that's your experience, you might be an addict like me. And I'm getting close to my time. I want to I hope that, you know, I just trust, I don't even hope, I trust that God gave me the message that he wanted me to share here today. And I know that God never lets me down. So sometimes my disease, when I get done with doing a share, like my disease will come in and try to pick it apart and critique it, and you know, it'll start telling me all the ways I fucked up and what I left out and what I didn't do right, and I just have to tell it to shut the fuck up, right? So I'm just gonna wrap this up, and I like to end my shares with this little story, and so I wanna share it with you, and I hope that you'll listen with your heart. There was this little kid, and he lived in Ashburn, Denmark. And every day this little kid would ride his bicycle down Main Street. And one day when he was riding his bicycle down Main Street, he saw a pet shop, a pet store. And in the window of the pet store was a little pile of puppies. And he thought that those puppies were the cutest that he'd ever seen in his whole life. So he jumped off of his bicycle and he leaned it up against the shop. And he went over and he pressed his nose against the glass, and oh, he loved those little dogs. They were so adorable. And there was like a pile of four or five in the front, but in the back, there was one little dog that was laying all by himself. And he thought that little dog was the cutest of them all. And he decided that he wanted to buy a dog, and so he pushed the door open to the shop, and he said, "Hey, mister, how much do you want for the little dogs in the window?" And the shopkeeper said, "Well, you know, I'm asking $2.50. And the kid dug in his pocket and he counted all of his change out, and he had $2.50. He probably had kroners, right? I don't know what they are, but he had $2.50. And he said to the shopkeeper, "Mister, I want to buy one of those dogs." So the shopkeeper took him over to the window, and one at a time he pulled the little puppies out of the pile, and the little boy would hold them, and they would lick at his chin, and they would bite on his cheek, and they would nuzzle under his neck, and one at a time the shopkeeper would put him back in the pile, and when it was done he said, "So kid, which one is it going to be?" And the kid said, "Well, you know, mister, I really liked all the dogs that were in the little pile there, but there's one dog in the back by himself, and I really love that little dog, and that's the one I want." And the shopkeeper said, "Well, you know, kid, I can't sell you that dog, because that dog is defective." And the kid said, "Well, what do you mean?" And the shopkeeper said, "Well, when that little dog was being born and he was going through his mother's birth canal, his hip got twisted. He got twisted and his hip got broken. And he's never been able to walk right. He walks funny. And sometimes he falls down and he can't even get back up. And he would never make a good companion for a fine boy like you." And the kid thought about it for just a second and he said, "I don't care, mister. I really like that little dog right there, and that's the one I want." And the shopkeeper thought about that for a second, and he said, "Well, you know, kid, I can't possibly sell you a defective dog for the same price that I'm asking for the perfectly good ones. So why don't you give me a dollar, and we'll call it a day." And the little kid thought about that for just a second, and he pursed his lips and shook his head, "No. You told me $2.50, mister, and that's what I'm going to pay." And the shopkeeper kind of scratched his head, and he took the kid and the dog over to the cash register, and he took the little kid's money, and he made a box with a handle on it, and he put the little puppy in the box and handed it to the little boy, and the little kid headed out the store. And just when he got to the door of the shopkeeper said, "Hey, kid, tell me, what was it about that dog, and why did you insist on paying $2.50 when I was gonna let you have him for a dollar?" And the little kid set down his box with his puppy in it, and he rolled up his pant leg, and on his leg there was an iron brace. He said, "Well, you know, mister, when I was getting born and I was going through my mother's birth canal, I got a little twisted and my hip got broken. I've walked funny my whole life. And my whole life I've been teased, and embarrassed and humiliated. I've been made fun of. And he said, me and this little dog, we have something in common. And I think that if he has trouble walking, I will wait for him. And I think that if I have trouble, he will wait for me. And he took his little dog and he left the store. And the reason I love to close with that story is because this is a story about the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. It's not our differences that matter here. It's the things that we have in common. That's the common thread of unity that binds us together. And it's not only that, it's that the members of Narcotics Anonymous were the first people in my life who saw my value as a human being. And I tried to sell myself short, even in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, for many years into my recovery. I thought I was only worth a dollar. And some of my predecessors loved me enough to say, Brenda, get up off your belly. Stop slithering around like a snake. You are worth more than that today. Everything I am and everything I have and everything that I will ever be is because of the grace of God and Narcotics Anonymous. I'm Brenda B. and I'm an addict.